Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. And if you would like to listen to other shows that we've done in the past, they are the last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And all of the shows, including the last five, are archived on the radio station at www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Well, okay, now let's get started. And today our topic is going to be what is right and what is wrong, and how do we determine that? How do we know when something is right, and how do we judge when something is wrong? How do we make that judgment? And, oh, I see we have a whole bunch of people already participating. Thank you very much for your participation. I love having you. And so I suppose that our question for today is, how do we know? How do we determine right from wrong? How do we judge that? How do we make the determination? And let's see, we have lots of answers already. Thank you very much for your participation. You know what most people are saying? They're saying that we know right from wrong because of moral standards. Because we know it. It's within us. It's our moral standard. And how do we get that moral standard? Well, people are saying religious values. Our moral standards are caused by our religion, by our religious teachings. Our cultural values, we've got some votes for. We've got religious values. Moral standards looks like it's number one. People are agreeing with that. And they're saying that moral standards are formed from our religious values, from our religion and from our cultural values. And, you know, several people, Robert and others, thank you very much for your participation already. Several people are saying that we know right from wrong because the law tells us what is right and what is wrong. In fact, several people are saying that they do not have a religious value because they do not believe in a specific religion, and they know what is right and wrong because of their moral values that are not religion-based, and because of the law. The law of the land will tell them that. And, you know, that's an interesting point, because let's think about this. Moral values, religious values, cultural values, and the law that's been created by the government, essentially speaking, and by lawmakers. What do those all have in common with each other? Oh, yes, look, you've read my mind. Yes, Phoebe says that they are all external teachings that have been internalized. Yes, let's think about that for a moment. They are something that we have been taught, probably from childhood, probably from being little, that we have internalized as our own moral values, right? Someone taught us our religion. Someone taught us our cultural. And somebody gave us the laws that we are following. And all those things have been internalized as our moral standard, right? They are something that we don't think about as being outside taught, but they're really external teachings, aren't they? And now I've got some disagreement. People are saying that moral values are... Bill says that human values are common to all, like the Ten Commandments. Now, this is a global show, of course, and I know that we're not all from the Judeo-Christian background, But we all know that the Ten Commandments are a basic set of rules to live by that tell you how to live with your neighbor. Thou shalt not kill, etc. And yes, I see a lot of agreement that everybody knows what we're talking about. Yes. And so Bill says that human values are common to all, like the Ten Commandments and the prohibition against murder for personal gain. Now let's think about it. Now we're getting a lot of disagreement. Thank you for your participation. Thank you very much for coming. We're getting quite a bit of disagreement with that, because people are saying that all right versus wrong values are society taught, are community teachings. Is that true, do we think? I think it might be a good point, because sometimes our community, and we see this from people that are committing, well, what some of us regard as crimes, and some of us, and I suppose they regard as revolution, are doing things that wouldn't be against, well, kind of against what we would think would be moral values. But maybe they shift. Let's think about that. Now, I'm getting quite a few actual callers on the phone. I don't particularly take live calls on this show. Thank you very much for doing so. I don't particularly do it because it makes the show very long. And we will get to all the basic questions and talk about them. And will you please email in at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. If I start taking live callers, it makes the... We usually keep the show to a maximum of an hour. And I think it's kind of long enough, don't you? Everybody's agreeing, yes, it's long enough. So please, if you're on the phone, please don't hold, because I don't take live calls. The questions will be answered, and if you email them in, I promise that we will get to all the different topics that are under this. And what we don't get to, we will, it's like an organic. These shows are organic in the sense that they are created by the questions that people ask during the week. And we get really a lot of emails, and people ask questions, and then the next show is a continuation of this one, and it kind of grows organically. If you listen to the archived ones on either the website, which is the last five, recipeforpeacenow.com, or you listen to all of them on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow, you'll see that they kind of grow out of each other. It's wonderful. It's fantastic, and I love having all of you participate. So we are talking about right and wrong and how we judge that. And we have thought about whether or not how we know that in our heart is internalized from external teachings caused by religious values, by cultural values, and by the law. And people are also adding family values. Now, I would put that under cultural, but it's a real good point that culture, I have quite a few people saying that culture is not the same as family. Culture is your ethnic, your society, and family is your family, right? Right. So it's not the same as cultural values, and you make a very good point, and I stand corrected. And so that those things are internalized by human beings and then perhaps converted into something that we can use, right? And, you know, Phoebe makes another interesting point. She says that right, as in right versus wrong, right is accepted and rewarded by society, God, and law, and wrong is punished by society, God, and laws. That's an interesting point, isn't it? And we're getting some agreement with that right is accepted and rewarded, and wrong is punished by society, God, well, if that's your religious belief, and the law of your land, right? And Thomas is agreeing. He says the fear of punishment creates right and wrong. Now, that's an interesting point, isn't it? That fear of punishment creates right and wrong. Yes, you see, we've got some agreement, but we've got some dissension. Thank you very much for all of your participation. Alistair says, but what if the law mandates something that is morally wrong? That happens, doesn't it? You see, society, and we'll assume, we won't particularly talk about religion on this show, but if your society thinks something and your law thinks something and they are in agreement and you've internalized those moral values, your faith probably is in agreement. Can we say that as a reasonable statement, that it is your faith will indicate that God is in agreement with the other two? Is that a reasonable thing to say? People are saying yes, that they don't know about the law part, but if your society and your culture and your family are all in agreement, it is a likelihood that if you're following the traditional path, that your religion is probably in agreement also. And that fear of punishment creates right and wrong. That's what there's some agreement with that. You know, but we have a real good point here, that what if the law mandates something that is morally wrong? For example, how about we use the Nazi government as a bad example, because they mandated, essentially speaking, mass murder, right? They mandated killing other people, and they punished those who didn't obey. You know, the law said that you were to report on your neighbors and to cause them great suffering and probably death. And that if you didn't obey that law, you were in deep trouble, right? But was it morally right? Was it even societally right and culturally right? We're getting some discussion on that, because, you know, we're kind of making a circle tonight, aren't we? And we don't usually. It's kind of like, does the law create the societal norm, or does the societal norm create the law? Well, that's kind of like the chicken and the egg. You know the old expression, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And so we will not spend a lot of time debating that, but we will just think about these issues. The reason being that as hosts, as third-party impartials, we want to be able to think about why people are acting in the way they do and about our reaction to what is happening and whether we think it is right or the right path or the wrong path. And if our societal values, and yes, you know, you're absolutely right. You're so smart, all of you. Pretty much everyone is saying that what we're really talking about is preconceived notions to a great extent. And we did indeed have a program about preconceived notions, didn't we? I suppose if we're going to go forward, we should have another one where we talk about everyone comes to any kind of a meeting, any kind of a mediation, any kind of a community get-together where we're trying to reach accord and consensus. We all come with opinions, right? And those opinions are often preconceived notions of what should be done, what should be the outcome, what we should agree upon or disagree upon, really. And those preconceived notions are indeed tied up, and this is true, you're absolutely correct, are tied up in our concept of what is right and what is wrong. They lead us to they help us make judgments. And they do. There are preconceived view of the world, so to speak. Can those judgments be altered? Can they be changed? Can they be reasoned with so that we can say, well, you know, I think I may shift my opinion. I may shift my preconceived notion. I may rethink this issue from a different perspective. And that's the key. That's the key to reaching accord, to reaching consensus. And that's where we're talking about how we determine right or wrong. And yes, you're absolutely right. It is indeed tied up with preconceived notions, too, right? And how we react and how we reason towards the common goal. The consensus, the common good, whatever it is that we need to do, to accomplish. And that's the key. You're absolutely right. And, you know, and okay, so we won't argue which came first, but we will recognize that we, as hosts, are reasonable people, but we have preconceived notions and we have ideas of right and wrong. And that those who we are dealing with do also. And we need to really understand that and factor it in and think about it. And think about whether or not it's having a great impact and whether or not we're acting in a fair manner as the third party impartial, as the mediator, as the host. Now, let's get back to this example. I've gotten a lot of people writing in about this example about the law creating what is right and what is wrong. And what happens if the law of the land mandates something that is morally wrong and has a punishment for not obeying it? Right? Laws all have penalties, right? Right, of course they do. And Alistair says that, and other people have said, that you can agree to disobey because of righteousness, because you have a differing opinion of what the law should be because of your moral standards, because of something that is right versus something that is wrong. And, of course, and we've got some dissension in the sense that people are saying that if everyone obeys except a very few, do the laws become right? Now, that's an interesting question. Let's think about that for a second. Because oftentimes, when we do these community get-togethers, oftentimes what we are trying to do is we are trying to change a law, a regulation. We are either trying to change something or we are trying to create a law, a regulation, so that all will obey it and we will get the desired result. We want to prohibit something. We want something to be accepted. We want a change or we want a, well, it's a change also to have a new law, to have a new regulation. But oftentimes, if you think about it, that's what we're really doing. We are trying to make a law change so that we can have a societal change. Does that make sense? Yes, I'm getting quite a bit of agreement that oftentimes that is why diverse groups have gotten together to reach a common goal. And the common goal is to do something with the law of the land so that it agrees with our opinion. Is that a fair statement? Yes, I think it is. And the purpose of our action is the changing of the rules. And so, if the law, if everyone obeys except very few, do the rules become right? And I'm getting a lot of people are saying no. The rules do not become right just because most people are obeying them. Because obedience does not create right versus wrong, does it? Like in the Nazi government, obedience was created really by fear of punishment, I would say. And, well, yeah, Thomas and Mo and others and Jasmine are saying that it wasn't really fear of punishment. It was greed for personal gain. And that of always is a factor to be thought about, too, whether or not there is personal gain to be gotten. But either way, most people do obey the law because it is an easier thing to do. And oftentimes we are interested in changing it because we don't feel that it is right. We feel that, now, Nazis are, of course, an extreme example, but many times we feel that a law is unjust, and therefore we wish to change it. And which leads us to the next question, doesn't it? Who makes this judgment of right or wrong? And who makes the judgment of how to go about fixing it? Because that's what we're doing, isn't it? It's not that we're even so much judging right or wrong. The thing that we're trying to do is fix something, right? And in order to fix something, we have to know how to go about doing that. What's the right way and what's the wrong way? And isn't that really where we have some dissension and discord within a community gathering, within a group? Yes, that's oftentimes the sticking point. We know that we would like to have this law changed, or we would like a regulation to become in effect, and this is what we would like it to do. This is the outcome. Oftentimes we can agree on the outcome, but the problem is the path to get there. Yes, thank you. Quite a few people have finished that sentence. The problem is the path. How do we go about it? What is right? What's the right path and what's the wrong path? And who is going to make this judgment? Who's going to tell us what path to take? How do we know? And let's see, we have quite a bit of participation. Thank you very much for all of your participation. And we have people saying that the leader being the host, or the leader being an organizational leader, a religious leader, somebody who is pushing an issue would be the leader. Someone who has quite a few followers would be the leader also. And we've got some votes for the community makes the judgment of which is the right way and which is the wrong way to go about it. And then we have tradition. And, well, people are saying the law and the court system, you can take it to court. I would say the court system and the law are kind of similar in a concept of going to an outside impartial third party to make a determination. A lot of people are saying the individual conscience, their moral values, their individual conscience. Thank you for all of your participation. And all of your, and quite a few of you are saying basically the same things. Now, the community is an interesting thought about who judges right and wrong. I'll assume the community is the people represented by those in the room. And yes, people are always saying you're going to say it depends, doesn't it? Yes, I am. I get accused of saying it depends a lot, but it does. It depends on the issues, I think, because if you're going to have the community in more of a democratic way, kind of vote for which way to handle things, the community must be fairly represented in the room. And it depends how complex the issue and how many groups, how many people, how many participants are involved. Because if you have a real lot, it's hard to reach every issue, every question maybe should not be put to a vote if it's going to take a tremendous lot of time and really bog down the process. You have to make a judgment about that, because I am very fond of creating consensus all the way down the line. It's a process, right? And people are agreeing with that. It's a process. You can't suddenly reach consensus. You have to work it up and back, right? It's a process. And if you keep the issues small and work towards and separate out the issues, and you reach consensus on the first one, and then consensus on the second one, and the community keeps going forward, then that's a magnificent thing. You've got it. Your process will go forward. You will be able to truly present your case to do whatever it is that you're trying to do. Sometimes the process will get bogged down, though, depending on the complexity and how many people. Now, I've got quite a few people saying that they think that the judgment of what you should do could indeed be handled by the court system if you have a law or regulation change that you're trying to affect. I know that I happen to be in the United States, and I know this is a global show, so whatever court-type system you've got, you can modify what I'm saying and what the participants are saying. But if you have broken a law, or you've got an example that you're using a case law, a case that's already before the courts, then yes, the courts will have a great deal of say, and you might appeal to the courts, and sometimes you even bring in a brief, a researched item, an issue paper, so to speak, even if you're not an actual litigant, and you might even be on one side or the other. And then the court system will indeed be involved. In the United States and in most court systems, I think, and you don't bother to disagree if yours does not, because I know that it's a global world and law works differently everywhere. But in most court systems, in most legal systems, I think in order to bring something before the court, there must be an issue that the court can adjudicate. It must be an active case. There must be I suppose some of your lawyers, is it true that you need to kind of break the law to be a litigant in order to bring something before the court? Yes, several of my lawyer friends are thinking, I don't do criminal law, which is why but even in business law and things, you need to have an issue before the court. The court doesn't act on its own, in the United States at least. And even if you are not in the United States and a court would adjudicate an issue that is hypothetical, I would think that would be something that would take quite a long time. And yes, several of you that are in, thank you very much for your participation, that are in countries where the court system is not exactly like the United States, are saying that you wouldn't take it to the court system. You would try to handle it through a traditional court system and not the actual legal one. It would be very dangerous to go before a court of law for a hypothetical issue. I would say that that's a real good point, and a lot of you are saying a traditional court, which I will assume means more of a traditional, through the culture or through the religion. Yes, a traditional court. So, yeah, court's kind of a concept of making who makes the judgment of right or wrong. If you're in court, and yes, you must accommodate the court judgment, but it's not something that usually is done first. And so we're going to make a judgment of right or wrong, the leader, the community. All of these are viable options. Tradition, the court system, individual conscience, which we've just decided is internalization of a lot of outside teachings. And the next question is, yes, people are already writing it down, and thank you very much. It's why, if these are all reasonable people and reasonable ways, why do all reasonable and intelligent people are so diverse in the outcome of what they think is right or wrong? We'll assume that they're all reasonable and intelligent, and they all want to work towards the path, and they all want to achieve the common goal. Well, how come we've got so much diversity, even within people who share the same religious and cultural background and are in the same legal system and the same part of the world and like that? And yes, thank you very much. We've got quite a few people. We've got Abigail and Thomas and Muhammad and others who are saying that it is a matter of interpretation. A matter of interpretation. How we look at things, how we think about things, is a matter of personal interpretation. And Muhammad says it's a matter of interpretation filtered through the underlying teachings. Yes, so we have an internal conscience, an individual conscience, an individual moral standard that tells us what is right and what is wrong. And it's an interpretation filtered through the underlying teachings. And that's why reasonable people with similar backgrounds can disagree. That's an interesting point. And we need to be cognizant of that, to be, well, I suppose to be accepting, but especially to be cognizant of it. And, you know, every time I do this show, someone comes up with something that teaches me something, and I didn't really think about it. And, you know, Jennifer is making a very interesting point, and several other people have made it too. Thank you very much. She says practicality under the circumstances is the deciding factor. And it's a question of what is practical to do under the circumstances, during this time, during this, to get to the purpose that we wish to achieve. Practicality. And yes, that does indeed raise the question of agreement of what practical is, which is being mentioned, and that's an absolute truth. It's kind of like deciding what is right and what is wrong. What is it that is practical to do? Sometimes we know that. We can make the issue smaller, and we know about it. For example, and yes, I'm getting quite a few people saying economics will make practicality easy to determine. It might be very expensive to do something, and we can't raise the funds, so we must do it a different way. It may take too much time, and we have a very short time period. We have a deadline that must be reached. We need to get on a ballot or something. These are practical questions that we must immediately get done so that we can and get to the right conclusion so we can push forward. So practicality. And William is asking a question of whether the easy solution is the right solution depends on the problem, and sometimes has more than one solution or can be divided into separate issues to solve more readily. Yes, that's what we're talking about. As we go forward, we decide, don't we, small issues on the path towards the goal, we decide the right and the wrong of many small issues to get to the right path, don't we? We make decisions. And, you know, it's a good point about practicality. And it's easier to get agreement when you break it down into single issues than have the whole. You know, that's one of the reasons that we are getting together and we are creating community and we are trying to reach consensus, because if you have a fairly complex issue, a fairly complex goal, it may seem very big, very impossible to do. So we'll break it down to create easier solutions in a practical manner, right? That's a very good point about practicality, because we need to work our way towards the solution and not just go, oh my goodness, we are so far apart, we're just going to quit. No, we're not that far apart. We can create consensus on the small stuff and work our way towards the big stuff. You see, several people have said that it's easier said than done. You've heard that expression, easier said than done, and you can say, well, we'll make it into small issues and we'll work our way forward. But it's it's a practical way of creating consensus. And you know, once you start agreeing with each other, once you start making consensus on the small items, the small issues, the peripheral issues, the economic ones, the tying ones and like that, you've already got some agreement, and that's a nice basis on which to build, right? Yes. And the thing that we're talking about with right or wrong, and yes, we are going to, and people are saying, are you getting to the recipes? Yes, I am. Is that the real caution of it is to understand that it's a fluid concept, and we don't want to be judgmental. And we need to consider all of the options, all of the sides, and not say, no, that is the wrong way of doing it. It might have some validity. It might have some practicality, yes. It might not be wrong. It just might be different. It might be a different way of thinking about it. And we need to be cognizant of our own feelings and careful to consider where the other people are coming from, where they are, what their background is, what their beliefs are, so that we can use the information to try to go towards the center. And that's really what consensus is, isn't it? It's some give and take in the process to not abandon our moral values, for heaven's sakes, but to understand them in the context of the particular issues, the particular purpose that we've come together for, and the particular point in time that we are together and that we are going forward to create a solution, a new regulation, a new rule, a new way of doing something when there was no accord or consensus before. And that's really the ticket. And that's why Recipe for Peace Now uses some convivial atmosphere, some networking, some food, because while we're doing this process, it's not easy and it's not smooth. And oftentimes, of course, we need to call a timeout, right? We need to say, well, let's step back and think about this. Or someone is very certain, it might even be one of us, someone is very certain that something is wrong or something is right. and they need a little breathing room to reconsider their initial reaction. And that's what the convivial atmosphere, what the process with using the food and the potluck is really for, as the concept for Recipe for Peace now. And I know that you can use anything to make a convivial atmosphere. Food is just easier to do. And it will create a way to make a neat transition, a neat timeout. A timeout being when you need to step back and think about something and not keep going forward. We need to take a break is what a timeout is taking a break. So that's the idea of the thing. And now we have made a clever segue, haven't we, into talking about our two recipes for today that we are going to share, that we are going to bring to a potluck, that we are going to use as a creation of a convivial atmosphere. And yes, those of you who have been here before, and thank you very much for returning, know that I'm going to say something that you've heard before, but it's very, very important. When you have people who are bringing food, it is very important to ask everyone beforehand if they have a food restriction, like an allergy, a dietary restriction, or religious restriction. And you will also have everyone who brings any kind of food to label the food, not just what it is, the title of what it is, but to label what is in it so that you don't have a nasty surprise. We have people that have all kinds of restrictions, and you don't want anyone to get sick. You don't want anyone to be offended or in any way have a bad time. It's part of the process, but it's also like a party. It's a convivial atmosphere that people want to return to, and you don't want to have someone get sick because they have an allergy, be unable to get sick because they have a dietary restriction, or have a religious restriction that they are offended that they've accidentally eaten something that is against it. So, very, very important. And those of you who have been here before, and thank you very much for coming. Thank you to the new people. The other thing that I always say is that I think that the host, which is oftentimes us, that the host should have spare food, so that there's plenty to go around and that there should be a safe recipe, something that most people can eat and does not have anything too exotic in it, and that you can see basically what is in it. And then you can have an adventure recipe too, which is something that is more of a complicated recipe, a complicated dish that is has more ingredients and may be ingredients that not everyone is familiar with or is more likely to be an allergic reaction or a dietary religious reaction. Okay, now that I've said that, we're going to go to our safe recipe first. And this is an extremely simple recipe. I oftentimes make it as my backup because you can see exactly what is in it. Most people do not have a prohibition unless they are allergic to tomatoes, and the tomatoes are very obvious. You can look at it and go, oh, that is full of tomatoes. And so it's usually not a problem, and it is something that can be made the night ahead. You could even serve this as a cold salad, and it's very easy to do and quite inexpensive. And you know, of course, that if you want to substitute something, you certainly can. I'm using ingredients that are common and fairly inexpensive to me in my area of the world. So we're going to do a penne pasta with tomatoes. It is cooked originally, of course. It's served warm. You can serve it cold also as a pasta salad. So we have 2 pounds of dried penne pasta, or some sort of a tube-type pasta, not a spaghetti-type pasta, something something round and thick. You can even use macaroni-type noodles if that pleases you. And we're, of course, going to cook the pasta in a large pot of lightly salted water until it is al dente, until it is, you can poke it with a fork and it's not squishy. So we're going to cook it like that. And while we are cooking it, we're going to make the other ingredients. So that's 2 pounds of penne pasta that we're going to now cook. 12 nice ripe tomatoes, little small tomatoes. Yes, you can use canned. No, I wouldn't in this particular recipe. And those of you who've been with me before know that I'm really quite fond of using the convenience of canned, because you're really going to cut them into big chunks, and you really can't do that with canned. It's too squishy a consistency. So 12, I like plum tomatoes, those little tomatoes that you cut into four so that you've got real firmness to it, because we're going to toss this. If you can't find plum tomatoes, use kind of smallish tomatoes and cut them into nice big chunks. And a small bunch of fresh basil, which we're going to make into strips. 4 tablespoons of olive oil, and some salt and pepper, and 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese, which we're going to sprinkle over the top of the salad, just because not only does it look nice, but it gives it some nice texture. Okie dokie. Now, we've got the cooked pasta, and we're going to chop the tomatoes into big, kind of nice big chunks. We're going to drain the pasta. We're going to toss it, and we're going to cut the basil into pieces, 2 strips. Into, not minced, we're going to dice the basil, make it into strips. So we've got the pasta, we're going to drain it, of course, and we're going to toss the tomatoes, the basil, the olive oil, the pepper and salt into the pasta, and we're going to top the whole thing with Parmesan. That's it. We've made it. We've got something that is very simple, very easy to do. You can do it ahead of time. Doesn't cost very much. And what have we got? We've got pasta, tomatoes, basil, and some olive oil, and some pepper and salt, and some Parmesan cheese on the top. Easy. Not too many ingredients. Excellent, safe recipe. You can see what's in it. It's pretty. And everybody likes it. And it makes a lovely side. It can be a main dish if you would like, if you serve it warm. But either way, excellent. We're all done. We have ourselves a lovely potluck recipe that is easy, and it is our safe recipe for today. Now, and it's also something you can really toss together in very little time. I frequently run out of time, and you go, oh, my, I have to go bring something to the potluck. I could do this. I could just toss some tomatoes and basil and oil and pepper and salt into some lovely pasta, and we're in. And we're going to throw some cheese on top, and we've got it, and big serving spoon. And there we are. Excellent. So that's our safe recipe for today. Now, here is going to be our adventure recipe. This is a little more complicated, but it is delicious. A friend of mine brought this to one of the potlucks, and I went, wow, not only is it delicious, it's absolutely yummy, and people are very impressed by it. It's kind of like, yes. So the first thing, we're going to have 2 pounds of nice firm potatoes, like a russet potato. Let's make it 3 pounds of potatoes. And we're going to peel them, and then you're going to cube them, big cubes. Like, if they're not too big, you can cut it into like 4 big cubes of potatoes. 2 tablespoons of vegetable oil. A nice big onion that we're going to dice. 3 cloves of garlic, minced. 1 cup of plain yogurt. 2 cups of thawed frozen peas. Yes, you can use fresh ones if you would like. It's just that frozen is very simple to do over here. A little bit of salt and pepper. About 2 tablespoons of butter. 4 tablespoons of olive oil. And in the United States, and I know that in a lot of countries, in the stores you can buy phyllo dough. You know that it comes in a big package and you have to thaw it overnight in the refrigerator because it's a frozen item. About 24 sheets of the phyllo dough. It's very, very thin. Because what we're going to make is we're going to make a potato stuffed phyllo dough. It is, we're going to make the stuffing, and we're going to roll it in the phyllo dough, and we're going to bake it, and it's going to be crunchy on the outside and vegetable-y on the inside. And yes, if you want, you can add a meat to this, like a ground, but ground, of course, a ground meat. I don't usually, because this makes it more of a vegetarian and less likely to cause dietary restrictions. But yes, you could. People are already asking if they can add sausage. Yes, you can. But, of course, you will need to cook it and drain it, right? Right, yes. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get a big pot of salted water, and we're going to put the potatoes in it and boil them until they're really nice and soft because we're going to mash the things. And so we're going to drain it. When they're nice and soft, we're going to drain it real thoroughly. We can get out the potato masher, which is good for aggression. You know, you can get a good mash on it, and we're going to mash it like we're mashing mashed potatoes. We're going to make it all mashed up. So that's the first thing we're going to do. And, of course, we had peeled them, right? Right. And the second thing we're going to do while we're putting this together is we're going to preheat the oven to 400 degrees and lightly grease a baking sheet so that the phyllo doesn't stick. Personally, and it's, you know, you've heard already that I'm in the States and it's easy to do. Personally, I like those nonstick sprays because they're nice and even and they don't add a taste. And they will not make the phyllo dough soggy or greasy on the outside. So we're going to nonstick a baking sheet. We're going to spray it. And we're going to make a 400-degree oven, and we've already got the mashed potatoes, right? Right. So now that we have the mashed potatoes, we're going to heat the oil in a big skillet, and we're going to add the onion, and we're going to cook it until the onion is nice and soft and smells lovely and like that. Then we're going to add the garlic, and we're going to cook it for another 5 minutes because we're going to make the garlic also incorporate into the onions so the whole thing is translucent but not caramelized. Now that we've got that, we're going to actually add the mashed potatoes, and we're going to stir it around until the potatoes are kind of coated with the oil and the onions, and the whole thing's been and the garlic and have been fully incorporated. So we're going to stir the we're going to put the mashed potatoes into the pot that we just made the onion and the garlic, and we're going to stir it all together so that everything's incorporated with the nice taste and the oil. Then we're going to stir in the yogurt and the peas and this little bit of salt and pepper. So we've got a lovely filling, right? We've got the tastiness of the onions and the garlic and the peas and the yogurt and the mashed potatoes and everything. And it's all very, very delicious. So we're going to give a little salt and pepper. Now, what are we doing with those phyllos, right? We're going to melt the butter in a little dish, and in a little pot, really. And we're going to add the olive oil. So we've got a butter and olive oil mixture. I like to use a pastry brush for this because it's easy to do. And I take out a large piece of wax paper. You can use a plastic wrap also, but wax paper is firmer and easier to work with. Because what we want to do is we're about to do the phyllo dough, and we don't want it to stick, and we want to be able to roll with it to make the stuffed roll. So we've got the butter and oil mixture, and we've got our pastry brush, and we've got our wax paper. And we're going to take a sheet of phyllo dough, brush it with the butter and oil, and then stack another sheet on top. I do it 12 layers stacked up. Is that a lot of layers? Well, I suppose it is, but the stuffing is fairly heavy because it's mashed potatoes and peas and like that. And I don't want it to tear. And you put the oil and the butter between each layer so that it makes it nice and fluffy, nice and crispy. Mm-hmm. So when we get the 12 layers all oiled up, we take half the potato mixture and stick it in the phyllo, and you're making a roll, right? So you need to leave a little on each end so that you can tuck it in. And then you roll it up lengthwise, tucking in as you go. We all have some sort of food that does this, where you make it enclosed. And then you roll it off the wax paper and onto the baking sheet that we made. And you turn it seam side down so that it crisps up properly. And then you've now got your other 12 phyllo dough layers, sheets, and you've got your other half of the potato mixture. You do the exact same thing with that. So we're making two of them. And, of course, if you want to make more, you make more, right? Right. You make more, you use more product. And so now we've got them both side by side. We're going to bake it for about half an hour, about 30 minutes, until it turns nice and crispy and brown. And it's just delicious. It can be rewarmed in a 400-degree oven for a few minutes to give it a crispness, to give it crisp it up again. And it's beautiful. You take a nice sharp knife and you cut it. Most people are not allergic to what is in that. It's basically vegetarian, unless you decide to add some protein to it. And it is very popular. So that is our adventure recipe. It's an adventure recipe because it has more ingredients. You can't see them all. And you never know what people might not be able to eat. Although it's not as adventurous as sometimes because it is kind of basic ingredients. So there we have it. And we're going to label everything. And I believe we are to the end of our show. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for coming. I look forward to hearing from you again. Thank you for all of your participation. If you want to contact us, it is recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. The last 5 episodes are archived on the website. And all of the episodes are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming, and please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.